when you went to graduate school, you went there, which you
got? Just for an MA. I went to a PhD at Columbia.
Columbia.
Yes, I had heard that Kroeber and Stewart were at Columbia, so I applied, and when I got there, they had left. So we were taught the gang of the Young Turks were taught by the younger professors, Morty Fried and Elman Service. The older ones were some of the worst teachers I ever had. Wasn't a very good education. The Michigan MA thesis, exam was 17 hours in four fields.
Gosh.
So you had to know a lot. By the time I got to Columbia, I didn't have to, it was a breeze. I mean, as far as passing PhD qualifying exams, which I did in a year. And then you could write your thesis, a library thesis, and go to the field afterwards at that time, which I did. So I had a PhD at age 23. And then I went to the field.
What was the thesis on?
Social Stratification in Polynesia was published.
Oh, that was the book. Hmm. And there, who was your supervisor?
Morton Fried.
What was he like?
Morty Fried was a very bright man, a very good man, humorous, intelligent. Engaged, inspiring. He's a great teacher. It's a pleasure to have him as a PhD supervisor, even though his field was China, I mean, and mine was not.
Hmm.
I also ran into at Columbia other people. I mean, Elman Service, and then outside the department, people like Polanyi, Carl Polanyi.
Hmm.
So it was a good 2 years. I mean, it only took me 2 years.
Mm.
And then the summer before I went to the field, I was the recorder for David Schneider's matrilineal kinship seminar. I was the recorder, drew the kinship diagrams. Then with that, David Averly, Kathleen Goff,
hmm.
Harry Basehart, among others. Oh, David, yeah, Averly. And Schneider was leading. It was at Harvard.
Was the dispute with Needham going on by then or not?
Not yet.
Hmm.
Well, Schneider was disputable, a disputing person all the time.
Yes.
However, I recently got back at him, and in my kinship book, I don't know if you've seen that.
Mm. The one that's just come out?
Yeah.
So you went to the field after your PhD. Where did you go and what did you do?
Well, at that time, we were all evolutionary anthropologists, and Morty Fried came up with this article, unpublished article that had been rejected by the American anthropologist, written by Paul Kirchhoff, who was at Mexico at the time, and who wrote, it was about conical clans, and we all thought this is a new kind of sort of stage of clanic development. This was a rank lineage system. And or a ramage, what Firth called a ramage. And with differentiation by seniority of descent. And we thought it would be nice to, everybody wanted to find an ethnographic example. So Fiji struck me as a good, it's a place where there was still, a culture more or less intact, and certainly in that respect. So I went.
Many anthropologists remember that Malinowski moment of arriving on the beach. Do you remember first arriving in Fiji?
Malinowski writing on the beach?
Well, he writes about the shock of arriving on the beach.
Oh, arriving on the... No, yes, well, there... He says, there it was, I will create it.
That's right. I will describe it all creatively.
Yeah, right. He was present at many creations, including kinship and so on. But, what my shock was, oh, that's tarot. There's tarot. I could identify it. The other shock was, interesting, this is interesting because I just fished up an old unpublished paper of mine which anthropologizes this issue, but I was taken under the wing by the head of Fijian Affairs, who was a famous Fijian called Ratu Solala Sukuna, and he were talking about where I should do work in Fiji, and he said, don't go to this place, there are very obstreperous. So I said, that sounds right. So I went there under his aegis and got a royal welcome of Fiji Kava ceremony, but a very high end one. And because he was a classicator, his sister's son in that area, beside being the most powerful Fijian. So everybody was there, and they said they wanted to know why I came, and I said, I said the usual things. I wanted to study their custom and so on. And the talking chief, Matsumi Ivanova, said, well, we're all here, what do you want to know? So I said, where did you come from? Oh, we came from Egypt through New Guinea and on a banana leaf from there to this place. Well, at that time I thought, I started with Tanganyika to Egypt. At that time I thought, this place is corrupt. I've since been able to decode these sort of neo-traditional myths of or traditions of origin that enlarge on a planetary scale, but without radically changing the structure of the traditional myths. Mm. So it's really a sense, a case of having a new cosmography opened up by colonialism and with new centers of power and authority, but a basic set of myths, voyaging myths, and relations of the voyagers to the inhabitants that is traditional. So I've basically been able to demythify these. In fact, I don't use the word myth anymore because I want to change all of the ethnological vocabulary that smuggles in our ideas of reality, like myth. I think, like, for example, the notion of mythical charter is one of the most foolish notions you could imagine. If myth has an implication of fiction, nobody has a constitution based on fiction. I mean, it's not a fiction. So it's only a fiction from our point of view, but it's not a good piece of ethnological vocabulary. So I'm against things like folk biology or mythical charter, or even myth itself. In any case, with regard to the Fijian thing, yes, I've been able to demythify it, to restore it to a place of cultural integrity. I'm happy about that. I just picked up, because we're going to this Fijian thing today, tonight, on the conference tomorrow, I picked up a paper of 80-some pages that I wrote that I never published in 1986. I was amazed at how good it was. And how well it dealt with this and several other related problems.
How long were you there on this first visit?
A year.
A year. And you've been back how many times?
About five.
Usually for some months or shorter?
Sometimes for the, usually for the summer. No. Our summer.
Yeah.
Their winter, fortunately. It's cooler. But I haven't been back since the 90s.
Where else have you worked?
I did a senior thesis on a Jewish mystical secret religious cult in Turkey in 1952. I worked in New Guinea for about 3 months, I guess, one summer on the north coast with a graduate student. And that's about it. I mean, I did an NRC investigation of Alaskan fisheries, Native Alaskan fisheries, National Research Council. You might have seen actually a reference to that recently, because it got involved in this in the international incident I set off by resigning from the National Academy of Sciences.
I gather you did that in the spring this year, is that right?
February.
Hmm.
Well, yeah, that was the only thing I ever did aside from elect members. I never understood what the National Academy was about anyhow. All you did was elect other people to the National Academy.
It's the same with the British Academy.
I'm also a member of the British Academy, actually.
Mm. I mean, it does more now.
But I'm not a voting member of being a foreigner.
Mm. You're a corresponding member, or foreign member, yes. Tell me how you work. I mean, your writing is both very clear and very humorous. Do you write on a computer? Do you write in pen? Do you rewrite a lot?
I never learned to type, basically, and I write with a 0.5 millimeter pencil and a pink pearl eraser on yellow 8.5 by 11 pads, writing every other line from about 8:30 or 9 in to about 11:30 or 12 in the morning, after which I don't write.
So 8:30 in the morning?
Yeah.
Until 12?
Something like 8:30 or 9 till 12.
8:30 at night?
No, in the morning.
In the morning, yeah. I thought you wouldn't work all night.
No.
So you write for about 3 or 4 hours?
Yeah, at the most 4 hours.
Hmm. And do you rewrite? Once you've written it out, do you have
the
it?
The first chapter, the first page, the beginning, I rewrite endlessly for 2 weeks.
Hmm.
I figure it's one of two problems. In order to write the beginning, you have to know the end. Or as one of my students said when I asked her why she didn't write her thesis, is that in order to write the first sentence, you have to eliminate every other possible sentence. So yeah, I think it's Said said beginnings are the hardest things.
Hmm.
So I write the beginning a lot. Usually I have to write it all over. I write a lot over, and I do it all by hand, although lately When somebody transcribes it on a computer, I've been able to rewrite some, if it's short enough, on a computer. But just two finger typing.
Hmm.
Slow.
Where do you tend to have ideas which you really value? Is it in the writing or is it?
It's about walking. Between the time I wake up and the time I get out of bed, about a half an hour.
Do you have a pad beside you and write?
No. Ogden Nash, the poet, American comic poet, had one, and he got up one night and wrote this genius poem that he thought of in the middle of the night, and in the morning it read, Hygamus, Hogamus, women are monogamous, Hogamus, Hygamus, men are polygamous. And he decided not to write it. No, I don't. Apparently, it was William James says, you learn to ski in the summer and swim in the winter or something. You, at night, your whatever problem you're dealing with, whirls around, and somehow are working on it. In the morning, it can become clear. I don't have to, in a very rare case, I will write it down when I'm drinking coffee if I'm afraid, if there's a particular sentence or something, but generally I don't have to.
If you were asked to select two or three of your either books or articles which you are most happy with, which would you choose and why?
I'm not terribly happy with any of them once they're gone. It's like when I picked up this Argos, I was surprisingly pleased, but I usually don't go back. So, and when I do, I sometimes feel that it's good stuff. I don't know. The book that sold the most, of course, is Stone Age Economics.
Mm-hmm.
Which to me is already from the Stone Age, if not the Stoned Age.
It's got some wonderful articles in it. They are wonderful.
Thank you. But I mean,
they've changed. I mean, so many anthropologists' understanding.
The chapter about the original affluent society,
yes,
became a hippie cult article.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It's had the most influence and sold the most copies, no question.
It starts with such a wonderful sentence about if the original whatever was dark and pessimistic, then anthropology, economics is the most dismal of sciences, the worst in this effect. I mean, it just rolls out in a wonderful way. Do you remember actually conceiving that article?
Well, actually, as one of the footnotes there, I think it was Elman Service really talking about Arunto, which set me off.
Hmm.
And he certainly he deserves at least equal, if not more, credit for the whole idea, because he was musing about it in class. So that set my interest, and I went around looking for the data, and it worked. And then in France, I published it first in French, in Les Temps Modernes. And that got me into the literary circles of France a bit. It was fun. But it's not, you know, in the sense of its public value and people telling me, oh, that's what made me an anthropologist or something like that. Yes, it's been the most powerful, but it's not necessarily one that I love the most. I think the little article I wrote on color is about as intelligent an article as I ever wrote, which people don't know much about, which is about it's a cultural explanation of why these people think there's a natural, the scientists like Berlin and Kate thought there was a natural sequence of color determinations. And it's about the semiotics of culture and the necessity for contrastive positions. It's a kind of a Saussurean analysis from the signified to the signifier. That is, if you're going to make a distinction of meaning, you have to have a clear distinction of sound, right? So the same with color. If it's going to be meaningful in the society, you can't have, say, a red that looks orange. It has to be a saturated red. It can't...
Except the Japanese flag is orange, and they call it red.
Well, they call an L and R too. I mean, that's they're entitled. They're not, but I don't mean simply a sign like a flag. I mean, a flag would do, but you know, like stop and go, and all that. And there was something I discovered in that article, which I thought was really interesting, and that is that people who are colorblind, red-green colorblind, can go through life without knowing it and call the things that we call red, red, and what things we call green, green, even though they don't see these colors. And the reason is that there's a difference of brightness between these colors, so that when people refer to them, they make a distinction, which means that they can share our meaning without having totally different experiences. and so the level of meaning is what's critical, the way that the level of perception, the mode of perception, or what you're perceiving, is not in itself critical. So I found that quite amazing. The other thing I found amazing is what I wrote the other day in the LRB about the nature of our science, our human sciences, as fundamentally organized by the fact that the way we work and what we're working on are the same thing, that is, they're meaningfully constructed. And so the method and the truth are the one, because our subjects are, like ourselves, symbolic beings who are organizing their world symbolically. And we have the power to decode it. And so an anthropological explanation involves reproducing in your mind as logic, which is something going on inside you, the way that world is constructed. So there's a fundamental, in the human sciences, a fundamental identity, what Vico called identity between the made and the true, the interchangeability of the made and the true. The interchangeability of the method and the object, since they are both, the method is trying to symbolically, to follow a symbolic construction and the logic thereof. And once we say, it's logical, we've incorporated whatever it is, cannibalism, Aztec sacrifice, whatever, as our own interior subjectivity. I find that amazingly interesting. And I think that was, for me, that was Levi-Strauss's biggest, the most important implication of structuralism. Other things I've written, historical metaphors was also very popular.
And Captain Cook?
It's a good book. How Natives Think is a good book. Mm. I mean, that was a response to a hard thing to do, decide if you were attacked or your work was attacked in what you thought was a spurious manner, and how are you going to do something like, apart from I didn't say that, or you didn't understand me, or in which case the thing goes on endlessly and you don't know where. And to decide, I only decide because Obi Sekra got all these prizes from the 18th century historians. And I thought, Jesus. And the anthropologists were all passing on it, if not pissing on it. So I said, really, I'm going to do a frontal assault. And I did. It worked, I thought, better than shutting up, which was the alternative. I don't know. This little kinship book I did, it's hard for me to tell if it means anything. I think only time will tell. I can. The Apologies to Thucydides I thought was a good book. It was all over the map, but it was a good book.
Culture and Practical Reason?
Yeah, that also got a lot of press.
Mm, it's a very good book.
But it's badly written, I thought.
Well, better than most.
Too dense. Yeah, it and the cookbook won prizes from the University of Chicago Press for the best book by a Chicago author published by the Chicago Press for the year.
That's good.
Yeah.
You have spoken about Levi-Strauss a number of times. Is he the anthropologist of our times, or your times, who you most admire, or were there others?
I heard Paul Bohanian once say, I've fallen at the feet of many masters, and I picked myself up and dusted myself off. And I feel that way. I mean, I liked when I was working at Michigan as a graduate, undergraduate student. Yes, Leslie White was a great man. Polanyi was a great man. Levi-Strauss was a great man. My younger teachers, Marty Fried, was a great man. I liked them all, and I learned from them.
What about Evans Pritchard?
Evans Pritchard, I appreciate more and more, I think, because especially recently I've been working on African kings. I'm trying to write a book on stranger kings around the world, and Africa has got nothing but a stranger king.
Hmm.
But I find his, some of his work, some of the underappreciated work, like the Senussi book, are sensationally good. I think that, yeah, he was one of the greats, no question. But I wasn't at that time very much. I mean, everybody read the Noir, of course, and Azandi, the Witchcraft, but I wasn't.
Did you know him? Told you? Did you meet him?
I never met him. I never saw him.
Did you know Jack Hoodie at all?
Yes, I know Jack.
He's a wide thinker, as you know, as well.
Pardon?
He's a wide thinker. I mean,
Jack is a great anthropologist too. He's a wise thinker and a bad lecturer. He wanders.
Yes.
But he's a prolific. I mean, there was this joke about him that I heard around here about a postgraduate student calls up his office and has to talk to Jack Goody, and the secretary says, "I'm sorry, he's on leave writing a book." And the student said, "Well, I'll just put me on hold." So,
what about Edmund Leach, the provost of this college?
Yes, Edmund Leach was another great man. Hmm. I did have, from the time I was assistant professor of Michigan, and he came by. Fortas is another guy. Hmm. And he came by, and from that time I ran into him several times, and we were together in one of these Winter Grant things. Hmm. So yes, there are certain things he wrote, especially Highland Burma, which are immortal. And also the stuff on affinal and lineal kin and things like that, consanguineal kin. Yes.
You mentioned going through the McCarthy period. And joking to your students about they better not go home if they didn't want communism. Did it affect you directly, McCarthyism?
No, I was pretty brash about it. I mean, I have the sense, or I was told that our classes were being watched, but I taught Marx during that period, and I was pretty, nothing ever happened to me. When I was first hired at Michigan, a very famous mathematician was kicked out, Chandler Davis, who was Natalie Davis's husband. There was some protest, but not much. I was never really touched by it personally.
You mentioned Moses Finlay.
Yes.
Being touched by it. As you know, Moses Finlay was an adopted name.
Yes, it was Moses Finkelstein.
That's right.
He was figured by Carl August Wittfogel, who also figured the British ambassador to Egypt, who jumped out of the window, a guy named Norman. Wittfogel, as I understand it, was himself a communist who was destined to receive the Stalin Prize, and when he got to Moscow found that he was not given it because the line had changed and that Oriental despotism was no longer the precursor of capitalism, and now it was feudalism. So Wittfogel didn't get the prize, and he got back on the train to Germany, where he was arrested for being a communist. I think that's what I've heard. Hmm. Who knows what the deeper psychoanalytic or psychological attributes were that produced Wittfogel's paranoia, but he was an absolute terror during the McCarthy era. And I read this testimony about Moses Finlay, and it was all hearsay, and the company he kept, and so on and so forth. And so Moses Finlay he got a half-time or part-time job at Rutgers. He was actually a friend of the Boas family. I believe that he spoke at Boas's funeral. Mm-hmm. But in any case, I saw him in the Polanyi seminar, and then And a lot of the stuff that Polanyi published about Aristotle discovers the economy, I think, was really Moses Finley, although the attribution usually runs the other way by Moses Finley. And then '56, I think it was, I was here at that conference on models. And Eric Wolf and I were walking down the street and hailed from behind by a man in a don scowl. And it was Moses Finley, and we went up to his room and had sherry, and I thought this was a good recuperation. And then before you know it, he's a professor of classics.
And then knighted.
And winds up Sir Moses Finley, living across the street from Jack Goody.
Owen Lattimore was another who suffered from all this, wasn't he? You may not want to talk about your political views over time, but have you been active politically, either at the local or higher levels? What are your political views, or were they?
I'm a populist. In America, I would be a man rather of the left. I was involved in the protests against the Vietnam War. I am the inventor of the notion of the teach-in and the first teach-in against the war at Michigan. I militated for a while in the Vietnam period, and then I went to Paris, and I was in the American, the Paris American Committee against the war. So I was sort of active in the Vietnam War. I've been a pain in the ass of the University of Chicago administration since about the 90s, when they decided to sort of commodify the university or to reorganize the university to increase the endowment. Rather than using the endowment to increase the university. I've written against the war in Iraq. I don't know if you saw my stuff in Anthropology Today. I pick my fights, but they're always on the same side.
Someone else who I think you know quite well is Keith Hart. Did he teach in your university for a while?
He taught at Chicago for a while.
He's a wide thinker too.
Pardon?
He's a wide thinker.
Very.
He's a fan of yours as well.
Yeah, well, it's a mutual admiration society. He's a very wide thinker. But in a different set of materials than me.
Africa. Just finally, your sort of what you enjoy most in academic life. Do you enjoy lecturing, teaching, writing?
Right.
All of them? None of them?
Writing.
Writing.
Writing first. Teaching, lecturing. I mean, to me, are virtually the same. I'm not a Socratic teacher. I'm a lecturer. That depended. Sometimes it was very good. Sometimes not. I didn't particularly like teaching undergraduates. I prefer graduate teaching.
You've had how many graduate students, roughly? Do you think you've
that I've supervised? I suppose on the order of 40 or so. 30 or 40, I never counted. They probably thought of me as an easy supervisor, with some exceptions.
Yeah.
I like low maintenance students. those who are really highly motivated. I've had some failures as students that I really thought should have finished and didn't. But teaching was, it's sometimes a great pleasure, but I get more pleasure out of writing. And I got even more pleasure out of reading ethnographies. cultural differences are for me interesting, very, especially if they're totally off the wall, like Shir Kagarov's shadows on the wall that have their own villages. Things like that I find fascinating.
And finally, just your family. You're married to Barbara, or you have children, or?
I have three children. One is a professional historian at Berkeley. A son, who's the author of some repute, including a book called Boundaries, which sometimes is a tribute to me. I would be glad to take credit for it. As one of our Spanish students said, you didn't write that, it's your most popular book in Spain. Okay, yeah. I think I've had enough.
That's excellent.